All right. Our topic for tonight is Achar Ha'am. Achar Ha'am. All right. Well, Achar Ha'am's real name was Asher Hirsch Ginzburg. Asher Hirsch or Asher Tzvi Ginzburg. A Russian Jew born 1856, dies 1927. One of the great spokesmen for Zionism, but also and simultaneously one of its harshest critics. Ginzburg, or Achar Ha'am, begins his life in a Hasidic family and receives some secular education in his teenage years, which leads him to a path away from religious belief and religious tradition. But,
where?
In Russia. Southern Russia. It was in the Kiev region, and then he moves to Odessa when he's on his own. And he, although he moves away from religious life, he does not move away from Jewish identity. And he believes very firmly in the survival of the Jewish people and in the national idea of the Jewish people. But his Zionism is not the same Zionism as those of Chibat Zion, or for that matter, those of the Herzlian types after the first Zionist Congress. He has his own mahalach, his own approach, which we later call cultural Zionism or spiritual Zionism. He believes that the Ruach HaLeumi, the national spirit, is to be cultivated and nurtured, and he was worried that it was declining. He avoided hyper-nationalism and chauvinism by positing a quasi-religious moral purpose for the mission of the Jews. That the Jews are not just like the Montenegrins or the Serbs who exist because they exist, that the Jews are supposed to be special and have some exalted status in the world because of our moral mission. Not to be Shomer Shabbos, but to be a light unto the nations in the moral sense. No, it's new only insofar as he eliminated the purely religious or ritual element. Because more typically, those who believed in the spiritual mission of the Jewish people had some kind of a religious doctrine. It may not have been the Orthodox one, it couldn't even have been a Reform one, but it was an avowedly religious doctrine, which Asher Hirsch Ginzburg does not have. He's secular, secular. No, it went to a Hasidic family.
What kind of Hasidic family?
I don't know. I don't think it was any cult. I think it was just Russian Hasidism. So, he said, the question of why be a Jew is a useless and senseless question. I know why I remain a Jew, or rather I can find no meaning in such a question, any more than if I were to be asked why I remain my father's son. Being I am, I'm my father's son, I am a Jew. We don't ask questions, I just am. That's what I am in this world. So, this is something that an Eastern European Jew could very easily think. A Western European Jew would likely not have the same attitude, because in Western Europe, the idea of forsaking your ethnic identity, aside from the religious identity, was very real. In the East, not so. Even the Maskilim, even the Apikorsim were still very Jewish. Okay. He says, religion didn't create moral feeling, but rather it was moral feeling that created religion. Whoa. Yeah. Now, that's not something that a traditional believer would want to hear, but it has a certain true ring to it in the sense that people, all human beings who have a decent moral compass, where do they get that from? Well, they start with it, and then where does that lead them? On the path of some denominational religion. And he's saying, well, the Jews were led down the path of Judaism, but it starts with the moral compass, and if you don't go down the religious path, so be it. So long as an ethnic and national Jew, you remain with that moral compass. He says it's impossible to be a religious Jew without recognizing one's nationality. Well, it's impossible for that, but it is possible to be a national Jew without religion. Now that's a disputed point, because there would be plenty of people who say you cannot be a national Jew without Judaism. Of course, in the state of Israel, this would become a real question. In the 1960s, for example, in the Brother Daniel case, of someone who's actually of another religion, but wants to be a national Jew, is that allowed? And what was the ruling in the state of Israel? You can't. You can't.
That's Brother Daniel.
Brother Daniel, right.
Yeah, but he was born Jewish.
Correct, I understand that. But my point is that the accepted approach in later 20th century Jewish life was you can't be a Jew unless you're a Jew by religion. Even if you don't avow that religion, at least you're ostensibly a Jew by religion. Okay, yeah.
You earlier said that it's morality that leads to the religious practice.
Uh-huh.
Where does the morality come from if it doesn't have a religious origin? What distinguishes the two?
So for Achad HaAm, there's a certain secular humanism which is going to lead to morality, but it's a secular humanism that is more pronounced among Jews than among others. So here's where you have a little bit of chauvinism in play, because he doesn't totally deny, actually he's not at all denying, the superiority of the Jew over the Gentile in the spiritual realm. It's just, it's not the matter of ritual law, but rather of the inclination towards moral doing and teaching. Okay, so he was not someone who needed to suppress religion in order for the for his victory of secularism. He was not a fundamentalist in that regard. He was willing to make accommodations. So, for example, when it came to the Jaffa Gymnasium in the early 1900s, he said, if the Gymnasium High School cannot continue to exist unless caps are worn in class, meaning yarmulkes, and higher criticism is excluded, I do not think this should be made a question of principle. In other words, we'll cave in to the religious if they want to wear yarmulkes and they don't want to teach apikorsis in the school. That they, although we would like this to be a secular school and no religious coercion and really no concern for the sensitivities of the Orthodox, if we have to give in on these things because otherwise there will be no school, then what do? We give in and we'll have a school. If he were a Fabrenta Meretz type, what would he say? No school. No school. Okay? Now, then he says, do you expect all the Jews to become free thinkers? No. I don't expect all the Jews to become free thinkers like me. I only wish we might have real people in Eretz Yisrael, even if it were all Orthodox, not the uncouth fashion of the Chalukah, but decent civilized men like the English like the Christian Englishmen whom I meet over here in London. I should be happy to live to fight against an orthodoxy like that in Eretz Yisrael. Meaning, if I have to fight college-educated, knitted yarmulke-wearing orthodoxy, fine, Baruch Hashem. As long as I don't have to fight the Chalukah of the old Yishuv, that my adversary should not be a kaftan-wearing old Hasid from the 1850s, but rather a graduate of Bar Ilan. That's what he's saying. I could deal with those guys. That would be fine in my book. That's not to say that he didn't do anything, because sometimes just for cultural sensitivities he might want to observe some enjoyable minhag or mitzvah, not because it's a mitzvah, but rather because it's a Jewish thing to do.
I mean, a Pesach Seder would suit him just fine.
Right, right.
Get a free drink out.
Yes, I'm not saying that he's philosophically consistent. That his philosophical profundity was not his calling card, but rather it was the intellectual ferment which he brought to the whole question of Jewish identity and the role of Zionism in Jewish identity. So, yes, you'll find holes in his logic. You definitely will. All right. Then he tried to synthesize deeply ingrained elements of traditional Jewish culture with an enlightened modernism, but that mix was a mix that is the certain percentages of this versus that are not necessarily based upon some real serious calculation. It's whatever he feels like. Then, in 1889, he established the B'nai Moshe Society, which was an elitist subgroup within the Chovevei Tzion, the Lovers of Zion. And it lasted for 8 years until 1896. And this subgroup, the B'nai Moshe, was not a secret society, but it was an elitist society, where their goal was to advance the national renaissance among the Jews of the diaspora and Eretz Yisrael. That whereas Chibat Zion was primarily concerned with colonization and the building up of settlements in the land, this was concerned with developing of nationalist sentiment in the heart of the people, awareness of Hebrew language, and of the need for rejuvenating one's Jewish identity for among those Jews where it was lagging, the Russified Jews of Eastern Europe.
Who was the Moshe that he had in mind?
That's a good question. No, I think it was Moshe Rabbeinu. Okay. So... It's not so easy, and he doesn't find necessarily the best of success. So in 1889, he writes his very first essay of any renown, Lo Zu HaDerech, This Is Not the Way, in which he criticizes the Chibat Zion movement. Bear in mind the following, that in 1881, when the pogroms start, you have societies being established all over Russia and Romania that are at the local level and wanting to support those who will make Aliyah. And there was the Katowice Conference in 1884, and there are some settlements being supported. By 1890, there are 8 settlements with about 2,500 Jews living in them. But for all the enthusiasm of the early 1880s, it was waning by the late 1880s, by 1890, and everybody's moving to America. There are hardly any Jews moving to Eretz Yisrael, and economically, the handful of settlements are in dire straits, and only survive how?
Chalukah.
Well, the old yeshuv survives on the chalukah, but the new yeshuv survives on a different kind of chalukah, namely that of Western philanthropists. So, James Rothschild in Paris, and Baron Hirsch, the two big machers, they are... giving money not as so much as pure charity, but rather to enable these communities to eventually become self-sufficient. And they do it with overseers who are detested by the local population, who don't like being bossed around by the baron's overseers. Okay, so in Lo Zu HaDerech, Achar HaAm says this is a silly approach, and it's ruining the nationalist movement. Who is joining the national cause? That's the question. Well, he explains, and I'll read it to you in the Hebrew. We'll give a little translation. Halalu shemitzad echad kvar nitropefa emunatam v'kashal kocham koch savlanutam l'chakot l'maase nisim. On the one hand, there are the people who have given up hope or patience in maase nisim. What's that?
Miracles.
In other words, we're not old-fashioned believers who are waiting for some miraculous messianic arrival for us to do something for Zionism. So we're not those types. But on the other hand, okay, mitzad acher, od lo nitrovev hakesher beinam uvein amam, v'od lo vitru al zechuto litkayem kam echad. The people who have not yet abandoned and given up on the idea of a Jewish nation that is entitled to live as Am Echad, as one nation somewhere on this earth. So it has to be you're not totally acculturated and assimilated, that you've rejected all Jewish identity, but you're also not a holy roller who believes in traditional messianism. You're somewhere in between. So for the somewhere in between types, what do you have available to you? Active Zionism. National Renaissance. Okay. But what happened? Even though this idea in the early 1880s was catching fire and thousands of people seemed to be in favor of it, somebody fouled up big time. And what did they do? They suggested Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, settling the land of Israel. And what's wrong with Yishuv Eretz Yisrael? It's too soon. It's too soon, and it will be done in a haphazard fashion, in a slipshod fashion, and it will result in failure, and will scare people off. Because everybody loves a winner. Nobody loves a loser. And if this cause is starting to lose, then people will jump ship. Okay. So, Chadal ata, achar nitzchono, liknot lo levavot chadashim labakarim. After some of our big successes, we're no longer attracting levavot chadashim, new hearts. Meaning the Jews in the pale around all the shtetlach are no longer attracted to our cause. Bilti im lirot b'shavatan shalotana koloniot atot. All they care about, for those who are still involved, is to just get along with or have the handful of colonies that we've already established survive. Whereas a few years ago we had high hopes for a glorious future, now the best we can hope for is that Zichron Yaakov doesn't go under economically. And so we'll throw them a few rubles and a few shekels and a few kopecks in order that they should have enough horses to plow the fields. But that's all we really care about anymore. So from high hopes to very minimal goals. Okay, he continues. Everyone's blaming somebody else. Whose fault is it? Why is the national movement sputtering out? So, halalu ma'ashimim et ha-chaluka v'rabanei ha-v'sofra. Some blame the old yeshuv, the chalukah and the rabbis. Okay? And that's fine, blame them, good. V'halalu, and other people blame, ha-nadiv ha-yadua. Who's the nadiv ha-yadua? Rothschild, okay, the known philanthropist, umalachav umeshata beretz Israel, his agent, his administrators in the land of Israel. It's always somebody's fault. And Ginsburg Acharam says, wrong. If this national cause really were a cause that was supported by the overwhelming majority of Jews, by the millions of amcha out there, then you couldn't have one man or a handful of people in a hovel in Jerusalem getting charity, ruining it. Meaning, if this were a real, like in Israel today, if a few people in Tel Aviv do something out of turn, the country's not going to come crumbling down. Right, it's an established country. So too, a national movement, if it had a million adherents and a handful of people were doing something that was off course, it wouldn't destroy the movement. The bottom line is, why is the movement not working out? Because we didn't convince the public that this was necessary. There only were a few thousand Chovevei Tzion. There should have been a million Chovevei Tzion. And we didn't do the legwork. Our focus was not on winning over hearts, adherents. Our focus was on building up a handful of settlements, and that was a mistake. Okay. Then he says, Lo b'mikrim bodedim efo, ma'aseploni o almoni, kim amok mize aleinu levakesh sibat kol ra. We have to find the real reason for all of our troubles. V'im kona asen, if we do that, we'll find the real reason. The real problem was the so-called victory. We stumbled upon an idea before it was its right time. It wasn't ripe yet. And that was our big error. Okay. So what needs to be done? You have to have people who are willing to use every ounce of their strength for the national cause. If you have fair weather friends, they're going to run away when the going gets tough. And we did not do what was necessary to develop true adherents who will sacrifice every fiber of their being for this cause. Okay? Well, another factor he starts talking about. In the Bible, what does the Bible care about in terms of success? What is the reward for good deeds? What is the reward for adhering to the will of the Lord? Huh? No, the Gan Eden is not in the Tanakh. Al ha adama. Bingo. So in the Bible, if we do God's will, then the national cause is advanced, which is our people in our land with material prosperity. What about the well-being of the individual? Where is there a promise for the well-being of the individual? Nowhere to be found. The yachid, the prati, the individual, he is supposed to do what? To sublimate himself to the national cause. That you do what is righteous in the eyes of the Lord, and we collectively will do well. But after the first Chorban, in Second Temple times, people were bothered by tzaddik v'ralo. It's, you know, theodicy, the righteous have it bad. So what's the answer? The answer is a hereafter, an individualized hereafter, in which if you're a tzaddik, what happens? You go to Gan Eden. Okay, so Acharam says that's the worst thing ever. Not the existence of Gan Eden, but that people believe in it. Why? Because then they're focusing on their well-being, whether in the Olam Hazeh or in the posited Olam Haba. What should they think about? Our collective well-being, okay, and we have to disabuse people of the notion of the Gan Eden for the Yachid and focus on what's going to happen to Am Yisrael. A socialist mentality, but not vis-a-vis a crust of bread, but with regard to the bigger issues.
There's always this tension between
Yep.
So you could also say the period of prosperity was depicted as
Gafnova tacha teinato. That's true. You're right. You're right. He sometimes over exaggerates the dichotomy, but he then says we need to spend a year, or 10 years, or longer than that, building up national sentiment in the hearts of the people. So kashav aruka meod ki lo l'shana. Valola asur, not a year, not a decade. It's going to take even longer than that for us to accomplish our goals. Zionist indoctrination. Well, was it successful? The answer is, in certain parts of the world, yes. I mean, for example, in Poland, in interwar Poland, Zionism was very successful among a certain subgroup of the Jewish population. Not necessarily among the Aguda types or the Bundists, but the Zionists were heavily represented in many of the countries in Eastern Europe between the wars. And, for example, in South Africa, everybody was a Zionist. In America, not as much. You know, by the 40s, it was more so. But it takes decades for Zionist sentiment to be so widespread. That's a good question. I don't have a great answer.
Good
Jews, yeah.
Was this written before the first Zionist Congress?
Yes, before. This is 1889.
What's his attitude change once that comes up?
His attitude will not change all that much. We'll see.
Mostly young people.
So it's interesting that the Chibat Zion was actually a lot of older people,
really?
But the ones who actually went to Israel were younger people. Okay, so he concludes this essay by saying that people were misled. They were misled to believe that you could solve the problem, the material problem of the Jew in Eretz Yisrael. If you're afraid of a pogrom, the Cossacks are after you in the Ukraine in 1884, 85, 86. Now what can you do? You can move to the Jezreel Valley and have a horse and a donkey and a plow and a house, and you'll live happily ever after with your family. He said it was all a pack of lies, that you weren't going to be able to solve the economic and material problem of the Jew. That we have to distinguish between Tzarat HaYehudim and Tzarat HaYahadut. That the problem of the Jew is solved where? In New York. Okay? In Boston, Baltimore, Philadelphia, or for that matter, London or even Berlin. That's where the problem of the Jew will be solved. You will not be hounded by Cossacks, and you'll make a lot of money, and you'll live a rich material life. But the problem of Yahadut, of Jewish identity, can only be resolved in Eretz Yisrael. And people who were not thinking about the problem of Yahadut, they were only thinking about the problem of the Yehudi, of themselves, were misled into thinking, if I go to Israel, it'll be all fine. And what happened to those people? Many of them either died of malaria, or stayed in Israel for a few years and left, and didn't go back. They moved on to another country, and were lost to the national cause. Okay. Now, why were they fed a pack of lies? Because the Chibat Zion crowd was eager to find people to move to Israel. Remember, it's not so easy to find such people. I mean, if you have a willing customer, even if they're on false pretenses, you take them and you send them. Okay. Lev ha'am hu ha'yesod asher alav tivneh ha'aretz ve'am karua ufarua. It's the heart of the people that will build up the land, but right now the people are karua, torn, uparua, they're loose, like a kifraoh haron, by the Chet HaEgel. Their ideology is not where it should be. They have a treif ideology in the eyes of Achad HaAm, whatever that might be. So he concludes with ki'im beruach. We're not going to solve the problems of Bechayel Bekoach, with strong hand and might, but rather beruach, with spiritual Zionism. And lastly, from my bar mitzvah parsha, Erenu velo ata, ashirenu velo karov. It won't happen now. It won't even happen soon. It'll be a while, but we got to tough it out. So, Parshas Balak. But do people want to hear velo karov? People want answers, and they want answers now. People are impatient. So, if an ideologist is saying velo karov, is he going to be popular? No, he'll have a small coterie of followers who think that he's the Gadol HaDor among the secular Zionists, But he can never be the leader of the movement, nor does he aspire to that. Okay.
You know, he sounds, there are a lot of religious overtones here in his.
Yeah.
I know he's not.
That's true. He's known as the agnostic rabbi, but rabbi. In the sense, there's a religious flavor to this. So he personally said you can have religious feeling without religious belief.
I know Israelis like that, and I know Israelis that way in the 1890s. Through generations of people, they are not
right. Okay, it's not an easy thing to sustain, a secular spiritualism. It's not easy to sustain, but for those to whom that idea speaks to them, it can be very fulfilling and giving, you know, richness of life. Okay, so in 1891, Ahad Ha'am goes on a trip to Israel. He goes on a trip to Israel, and he writes a missive. It gets published in one of the Hebrew periodicals. When he gets back, he wrote it on the boat.
He wrote in Hebrew?
He wrote in Hebrew. Now, let me tell you about his Hebrew. His Hebrew was qualitatively different from many of the other Zionist writers in that the earlier ones used a modern Hebrew that was really tinged with rabbinic Hebrew and Talmudic and biblical citations. Ahad Ha'am tried to avoid that. He tried to use a pristine non-Judaic Hebrew, which didn't exist yet. And he talks about in one of his letters here how we have a problem that the language is not sufficiently developed, and that's going to be a difficulty in terms of pedagogy. The teachers won't know how to teach the students because they don't have the words to use. But he has a very sophisticated Hebrew, but sophisticated without Judaic content. And that was intentionally.
Is he friendly with Eliezer Ben Yehuda?
Yes. Okay.
So, but
whereas Eliezer Ben Yehuda was a linguist, Ahad Ha'am was more of a spokesman / propagandist. Okay, so in Emet.
Is that the equivalent of an academy to set standards?
Yes, Ha'akademia LaLashon HaIvrit. It was established by Ben Yehuda in the 1920s.
In those days?
No, in 1920 it was established. So, Emet Me'eretz Yisrael, the truth from the land of Israel. The very title tells you what? That in the view of Ahad Ha'am, other people were saying, Sheker, they're telling you falsehood, and I'm going to tell you the unvarnished truth. Okay, so he starts off by saying that after many, many years of thinking about Eretz Yisrael and having dimyonot, imagination in my mind of what Eretz Yisrael really is all about, I decided to go and to spend 3 months in the land. All right, well, he wants to tell you what really happened. Okay. Ra'iti et chorvoteha, I saw its ruins. She'erit chayel she'avar, the remnants of life that once was there. Hitbonanti el matzva ha'omlal ba'oveh, and I see its terrible current situation. Ach bi'yichud samti lev el ha'atid, but my main focus was on what the future could hold for Eretz Yisrael. And I kept asking myself the following question. Matik vatenu po la'acharit hayamim. What future do we really have here, in a generation, 2 generations, 3 generations from now? So we in the Hatikva say, Od lo avda tikvatenu. But he, before even Naftali Herzimber wrote that song, was thinking, what is our tikva here? What can we possibly hope out of this country? Ha'im mukhsheret od ha'aretz la'shuv l'chyot. Can the physical land be revitalized? That's question number one. And question number two, Im mukhsharim b'nei Yisrael ashuv l'achyota, are we the Jews, the Jewish people, a suitable bunch to revive the land? So one is a question about the physical capacity of the country, and the other is, are we the right people to get that done? What are the chances of success for our people? Okay, so on the question of the land, he says there was an obvious answer, that the country can sustain a population. That there are the hills and valleys and it's beautiful and there are fields and orchards and the like. And even though the Arabs are lazy bums, the country is still yielding fruit. He says, Hanotnim piryam lamrot kol atzlut haravim. Even though the Arabs are lazy, the country still is producing something. So all the more so, kal vachomer, if we were the ones working the land and we're going to try hard, it'll yield a bountiful harvest. Okay. All right. But what about the question of Yisrael? Our ability to get things done. And on that, he was very saddened. Atahini azavti d'aretz masot nafshi. I've left the country. And dimyoni lo ben chorin hu. Ata lagbia of kimlefnim. Lo chalom na'im li. Od ha'aretz v'yoshve v'chol maseh sham. I no longer have this beautiful dream. Kim emet muchashit. But rather, the real, tangible truth. Mugbel b'tzvei yudah mekevet mechazyonot yiduim. Tovim v'raim. Okay, I have mixed feelings, but I can't deny and gloss over some of the less pleasant stuff. I want to reveal a tefach. What's a tefach? A handbreadth, a small amount of the truth. The ugly tefach. I want to tell you the ugly truth. Okay. So I'm not going to do what the others did. The Kino L'Shirei Tzion, to sing Zionide songs about how wonderful the land is, that it's metuka, it's sweet, and everything is pleasant. But rather, I'll tell you we have a crisis on our hands. That things are not good. Things are not good. And we're making a mistake, and a mistake can have dire consequences. Kishgiyachat, one mistake, te'abed lefamim tova harbe, can destroy a lot of good. And all the more so when these are foundational mistakes at the very beginning. If you make an error when you build a tower, the tower will eventually collapse. It's one thing if you make a mistake on the 80th floor, so the 80th floor needs to be redone. If you make a mistake at the bottom, the whole thing comes crashing down eventually.
He's a real pessimist.
No kidding. So,
did he mention
any of the Arab, we're going to get to that right now. So he then says, what about our options here? People have to go somewhere. It's either Eretz Yisrael or America. And as I mentioned before, Eretz Yisrael solves the problem of Yahadut, and America solves the problem of the Yehudim. But we care about the Yahadut. We care about national existence, and we would like to see the buildup of Eretz Yisrael. And the problem is Eretz Yisrael does not solve the problem of man nochal, what shall we eat? You know, in the Bible, in the Talmud, On the side of every page, you have Tosfos. With what words does Tosfos introduce a question? Ve'im tomar. And if you'll say, that's how Tosfos, and what's how do you answer? Ve'yesh lomar. Ve'im tomar, ve'yesh lomar. In the Bible, what's the only ve'im tomar? Ve'im tomar manochal b'shana hashvit. What do we eat in the sabbatical year? In the Bible, the only question is, what do we eat? Physical survival. And physical survival is not going to be guaranteed in Eretz Yisrael. Okay, life isn't so pleasant there. So, that's not gonna go over well with people. They don't want to hear that. They wanted to hear that life would be pleasant. Then he concludes the first message from Eretz Yisrael.
Isn't that good either, is it? Is your Benny better?
Depends where. Yeah. Eastern Europe, no, but Western Europe, yes. Okay, so he ends his first missive with a trip to Yerushalayim. So he went Erev Pesach to Yerushalayim, and he went to the Eitzim Va'avanim. What are the Eitzim Va'avanim? The relics of the past, meaning the Kotel. What you would call a holy site, Mekomot HaKadoshim, to him are Eitzim Va'avanim. Because what are they? They're just relics. They're sticks and stones, okay? Now, so he goes to the Kotel. Sham matzati rabim me'achenu yoshvei Yerushalayim. I saw some of the Jerusalemites omdim palim b'kolei kolot. They're davening in loud voices. Prehem hadalim. They're sad and poor faces. Tenuotehem hazarot. In their bizarre gesticulation, they're shuckling up a storm as they daven. Okay, umalbushehem mishunim. They're funny garb. They're wearing the garb of the old world, whether of the Eastern European old world or, for that matter, even the Sephardic old world. Hakol matim l'mareh ha-kotel hanora. It all fits all too well, that the ancient Kotel. And I stand there and I'm looking, and a thought fills my mind. Ha'avanim ha'ele, these stones, Edim Heim al Churban Artzenu. They are a witness, a testimony to the destruction of our land. V'hanashim ha'ilu, and these people, al Churban Amenu, to the destruction of our people. Meaning, it's horrible, these people. What are they doing? Old world Jews shackling up a storm at the in front of a wall. We need to have modern people with modern ideas and progress and an economy. Okay? Eze mishnei achorbanot gadol mechavero. Of these two destructions, which one is bigger? The land or the people? And so he says, when the land was destroyed, people were sent to Babylonia. But what happened? Zerubbabel, Ezra, and Nehemiah bring the people back. So the demise of the land can be rectified. The demise of the people, infinitely worse. Now that's a very condescending thing towards the old world Jew. So here the agnostic rabbi, Asher Hirsch Ginsburg, the Achar HaAm, is writing in terms that, like anti-Semitic. If a goy said it, we'd say he's a vicious anti-Semite. But that's the way he feels. Huh? Correct. It's the way that the Geiger types would have made fun of the old worlders. All right. So this was in 1891. But he goes to Israel again in 1893. And on his way home in 1893, he writes another article in which he addresses, who mentioned the Arab problem? The Arab problem is brought up here. So he goes back to Israel, wants to see what's happening there. And things have not improved all that much.
What did he do for a living?
These guys never worked. No, I take it back.
No.
So the truth is, he worked for Vizotsky, the tea company, and he moved to London in 1907 to be an agent for Vizotsky. But what he did before that, I don't know who he worked for. But
that's a tea that still is around
today. Yeah, sure, yeah. He was the London agent for Vizotsky's tea company. No, that's a real job. He had Parnassa. Okay. I don't know. Yeah. Could be. He had two kids. I mean, he got married young. He got married when he was still religious. As was often the case, people who had a metamorphosis already were saddled with a wife and children before they became apikorsim, and which sometimes led to divorce and there's problems. Okay. All right, huh? Yeah. Okay, so in 1893, he writes his second Emet Meretz Yisrael, and this time he talks about the language and how in the schools it's a real problem because the teachers want to give over the scientific subjects to the students in Hebrew, but they lack the words with which to do it. And in the end, the kids are left with only a smattering of knowledge in broken language. And this teacher invents one word for a certain concept, and this teacher invents another word. There's no uniformity of modern expressions. Everybody comes up with their own version of what to say, and that's not good for communication that is intelligible between people. Okay, but he also talks about the issue of the Arabs. So there was a thought process among the Chibat Zion crowd that the Arabs are wild barbarians and are stupid and don't know what we're doing, and we could pull the wool over their eyes and take over the country before they'll even know what's what. Well, among some, yeah. So there probably were about 300,000 Arabs at the turn of the century. Okay. 40,000 Jews. Okay. So... They live there. Whoever owns it formally is a separate matter, but people live there. So, he says there is an Arab problem. He even anticipates not only a local backlash, but actually an Arab national movement. He anticipates that even before the Arabs themselves are thinking of it, but he foresees the future. He is quasi-Nevuah here. He says, Palestine is not an empty country. And, very importantly, there isn't any good land to buy. If you think that the country is relatively empty and there's a lot of land for sale, you'd be wrong. Because it's not easy to find a seller. And what are they willing to sell? The stony hilltops, which are not easily cultivated and would require tremendous effort to produce a yield on that kind of soil, or swamps, you know, marshland, but drained fields that are ready to be used for a, you know, a cereal crop or vegetable crop, are not easily purchased. So, what are you thinking? Now, then he says, Turkey can't be bought off with some bribery. That was the other misunderstanding that the early proto-Zionists had. They thought that Turkey is, you know, teetering on the edge of insolvency, and that for the right amount of bribery for bakshish, or for even above board payment, the Sultan will sell off large chunks of land to Jewish autonomous control. He said, that's not going to happen. Whoever came up with that idea was just in the wrong. They didn't know what they were talking about. And we should stop thinking along those lines. It will not happen. Okay. Then, he said, the morality of our settlers in their mistreatment of the Arabs is disconcerting. That they're bossing them around and mistreating them, it has to come to an end. Aside from the fact that there'll be a violent backlash from the Arabs for their mistreatment, there's also just the moral issue of it's not right that we do this, even if there weren't any violent backlash. So that's Acharam 1891-1893, Emet Me'eretz Yisrael.
How do you reconcile that with the way ahead? How do you reconcile
Okay, so I'll explain what he thinks is should happen next.
Where is he writing it? Who is reading it contemporaneously? And what are they thinking about when he's writing it?
Okay, so he's writing it in Hebrew publications, often Hatzefira or Shiloach, in Eastern European Hebrew language publications. The reading public for this are the readers of the Hebrew Periodical Press, which are people who are usually with Zionist inclinations, but sometimes those who have the exact opposite feeling. They want to know what the enemy's thinking within the Jewish camp. So the masses are probably not reading Achad Ha'am because their ability to read literary Hebrew is limited. Remember, for the average Yiddish speaker in the Pale, they know Siddur Hebrew. They don't know literary Hebrew. They know Chumash Hebrew, right. So they can, but they could be told the gist of it in their meetings at their various Chibat Zion chapter organizations. So he's very popular as a spokesman for the national cause, but people are turned off by his pessimism because nobody really likes a pessimist. And yet he feels it's necessary to disabuse everyone of foolish notions. And if we have to have a healthy dose of pessimism, so be it. Okay. Well, yeah.
So
the first Aliyah is from roughly 1881 or 1882 until the turn of the century.
So that's Chibat Zion.
Correct. So that, you're referring to Avodah Ivrit. Avodah Ivrit was the second Aliyah.
Oh.
The second Aliyah, and they were angry with the first Aliyah, because the first Aliyah, those who actually survived and made a go of it in Israel, very often hired Arab laborers and were living off the fat of the land and were no longer getting their hands dirty. And when the avowed socialists came in 1904, 5, 6, 7, the Ben-Gurion crowd, the Yitzhak Ben-Svi crowd, they were aghast at how these capitalistic first Aliyah folks were no longer really tilling the soil. And that bothered them. And the response was, Avodah Ivrit, Avodah Ivrit. Yeah.
It's almost like today.
Huh?
It's almost like today.
Well, today, they're but you should know there are those who feel that the state is suffering as a result of it and would like, with also a certain dose of chauvinism and racism, to kick all those people out and go back to manual labor. It'll never happen. It'll never happen. But there are certain right-wing ideologues who feel that it would be healthy for the Jewish society to kick out all the foreigners and get our hands dirty again. Yeah.
No,
And the centerpiece was four maps of the ever-expanding Israel. Yes, displacing, presumably,
right.
The Palestinians.
Okay,
who would he vote for today?
Huh?
Who would he vote for today?
I have no idea. All right, so one last article of his that I want to talk about before we get to his actual plans for a future of Eretz Yisrael is Avdut Betoch Chirut, slavery in freedom. Slavery in freedom. So slavery in freedom, which he wrote in the 1890s, was an attack on those Jews in Europe who were complacent and believed in the future of Jewry in Europe. Whether the Russified Jews in Moscow and St. Petersburg, or more so, the French Jews and the French Jewish leadership, who felt that we have been fully emancipated, we are Frenchmen, and we're also Jews, so there's no need for national consciousness. There's no need to raise national consciousness. In fact, it's unhelpful. Rather, we should suppress it and be happy with our lot where we are. After all, we are free. Chirut. Achar Ha'am's retort was, you're not really free. Avdut b'toch chirut. You're in a spiritual and intellectual slavery. How so? That whatever residual Jewish sentiment you really harbor deep in your heart, you're consciously suppressing, even though you don't really want to, just because you don't want to get caught having it. That you're afraid if your emancipators would know that you have a Pintala Yid deep down, and the Pintala Yid has more than just a religious overtone, but also a ethnic, a national overtone, that they would accuse you of treason and treachery, so you don't say it, you don't admit it. So you'd like to say it really deep down, but you can't. You're a slave within your own freedom. Also, what else? To what else are you enslaved? So he has a great line. I'll give you the exact in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, Avdut b'toch chirut, towards the end of the article. Okay, regarding anti-Semitism in Western countries. The Jew who believes, let's say during the Dreyfus trial or even before that, that modern anti-Semitism of Wilhelm Marr, the League of Anti-Semites, and other types who exist in Central and Western Europe, those who are afraid of it, but have made their bed with Western emancipation and don't want to leave, the only thing they can say is, well, this is a passing dark cloud. It will come and it will go. All right. The success of this nefarious movement is only zmanit, temporary. But it'll come and it'll go. Because really, the emancipation from 1789 and 1791, liberty, equality, and fraternity, that's going to be the wave of the future that ultimately wins the day. And the vicious racial anti-Semitism of a few grubber mention is going to come and go. Now, do you folks really believe that? Or are you just saying it to make yourselves feel better? You don't really believe it, but you're enslaved to your ideology, and so you have to say it. Avdut betoch chirut. It's one of his best articles because it has nothing really to do with the Zionist cause per se. It's not about what's the best method to advance Zionism. It's just attacking those who oppose Jewish nationalism and saying, you think you have it good, you don't really have it all that good. Okay.
Was not conscious of his duties per se, and he was a reluctant hero.
So, but Achar Ha'am, I don't know. I mean, Herzl is the popular, the conventional wisdom on Herzl is that the Dreyfus affair aroused him to Jewish national consciousness. The truth is, when we discuss Herzl after the Chagim, we'll see it's not really true. He already was thinking about Jewish affairs in the 1880s when he was a young university student and would-be lawyer and then playwright. And Dreyfus had some effect on advancing the ball of his Zionism, but was not the it was not everything. Okay, so back to Achar Ha'am.
Who?
Yes, yes. So he was at one of the Zionist congresses. It was not the first one. I believe the only one he attended was in 1903. I think the sixth. The sixth. Yeah. There were 204 delegates.
Yeah, think about it. No internet, no telephone.
They sent out a lot of invitations, and people responded. They were interested. Okay, so in 1897, you have the first Congress, which we'll talk about at length after the Chagim. But Achad Ha'am's reaction to the Congress was to write an article, as was his style, and the title was "The Jewish State and the Jewish Problem," in which he said the following. Even if a state were formed, it could not possibly absorb the majority of the Jewish people. They would still be stuck in the diaspora with all their problems. Zionism, therefore, must solve the spiritual problems for those millions of Jews who are destined to remain for several generations more outside of the Jewish state. That's a critical point. And he's right about that. I mean, when Israel was founded, it was only 600,000 Jews, and even for the first few decades of its existence, it only had a small percentage, a minority fraction of world Jewry. So the problem is, how do we save diaspora Jews from being lost and from their problems? And what is their...
Temporary.
Well, yeah, but what's the solution? So he says... Well, the Holocaust was vis-a-vis Zionist ideology and early Zionist thinking. The Holocaust eliminated the vast bulk of the population that was intended to move to the land, and created a situation in which there really wasn't going to be much of a European diaspora that was still struggling with its neighbors and with its Jewish identity. What was left? An American diaspora, which was integrated into its host society, was materially very successful, and was primarily of a religious orientation. Now, not a very firm one, but a religious orientation in the sense of conservative, Orthodox, Reformed, Reconstructionist, not nationalist. Okay? So, the success of political Zionism could be a solution for the assimilated but anxious Western Jew. The Eastern Jew, however, has a different problem in that his traditional Judaism is dying. This is critical. Who are the Zionists? Goyish Jews, basically. Herzl, Nordau, assimilated, half assimilated, intermarried types who live in Central and Western Europe, who are not religious in the least, who don't know an ounce of Hebrew, who know nothing. There's no Yiddishkeit there at all. But what? They're a Jew. And they're uncomfortable because there's anti-Semitism, and their place in Western Europe is no longer secure like they thought it would be, so their solution is to move to a Jewish state, the Switzerland of the Middle East. That's political Zionism could solve their problem. But political Zionism is not going to solve the problem of 5 million Jews in Tsarist Russia who aren't going to all make it to Israel right away because it can only handle X number of thousands per year. And the 5 million Jews in Tsarist Russia, their problem is Judaism. Judaism is dying. Now, is it really? Yes, it is. Okay, for all the talk that pre-war Europe was very firm, it wasn't. Okay, there were a great bulk of the people were no longer religious and not interested in being religious. And if not for Zionist fervor, would have fallen into the trap of assimilation, whether into communist Russia or nationalist Poland, or they would become Magyars and Hungarian nationalists, okay, or Bundists. But the point is that Judaism of the past cannot sustain them in the future. So unless you create some other secular Jewish identity for these people, they will not exist as Jews anymore. And if we care about the Jewish national cause, then their assimilation and their loss would be our loss collectively, since you can't afford to just write off a tremendous percentage of your public, as is happening in America today. American Jewry is horribly assimilated, and you know, they're lost to the cause of the Jewish nation. But what if that had happened in Eastern Europe too? It would have been a disaster. Okay, so Achad Ha'am opposes the Basel program. Now, the Basel program was, we're going to call for an internationally recognized charter for the Jews to have control of Eretz Yisrael. He opposed that because if you don't have strong nationalist roots, it will fail. He doesn't trust the Zionist organization because the Jews of Eastern Europe have not been sufficiently woken up to the national cause. And Herzl is a Goyish Jew, doesn't know a thing from Judaism. So you have like the blind leading the unconverted. Yeah,
really,
sure, yeah,
really,
sure.
You know, he may not have said it in so many words, but certainly the influence of the timing is everything.
Timing is critical. So, he then says, a spiritual center must be created in Eretz Yisrael, which will radiate light to the diaspora. So we do need Yishuv Haaretz. There must be people who move to the land, but it has to be the right people. Anashim Nechonim. Nechonim in the double sense of the word Nechonim. Correct and also prepared, ready. Because if you have the wrong people, either they'll leave and you'll have zero, or even if they stay, it won't be a spiritual center radiating light to the diaspora. So, what did Achad HaAm have in mind? It would not have been a statehood. It would have been sort of what existed during the British Mandate, where the Jews don't control the country. No, not at all. Some foreign overlord controls the country, except instead of the Turkish, it's the British. But what is being built up?
A university.
Culture. A university. An all-Jewish city like Tel Aviv. Hebrew language. Hebrew newspapers. Okay? And even by the religious, Mossad HaRav Kook, producing Orthodox literature, but not of the sort of the crazy variety. So, or Mossad Bialik. All the great Hebrew literature that came out of Eretz Yisrael, 20s, 30s, 40s, the aura that was being spread out to even to America. Remember, in America, in the interwar period, when my grandmother went to Cheder, all right, in the Nulatz Talmud Torah, and then when her siblings went to Herzliya and Marshalia in Manhattan, what was that? Those were emissaries sent from Eretz Yisrael to spread the light of Zionism in a nominally religious but basically culturally Jewish environment that was to convince people of the importance of Yishuv Haaretz in Hebrew and Eretz Yisrael. Yeah.
I mean, he wants to build up a cultural infrastructure, basically.
Yes.
But you can't do that without
true. So he's not denying that you need to have some physical infrastructure. But what he would say is, instead of trying to have too many moshavot and koloniot, as he calls them, in the Jezreel Valley, in the Galilee, in the Judean Hills, it's much more important to have 50,000 Jews in Tel Aviv with culture than it is to have guys with a plow and a horse, 30 miles away in the fields.
Who's going to support them?
All right, so that's why there are limits to the ability of a community to implement spiritual Zionism along the lines of Achad HaAm. That he could not be the only type of Zionism out there. If he were, the whole thing would have collapsed. But he has a point. He has a very important point that if the community, the Yishuv HaChadash, as opposed to the Yishuv HaYashan, if the new Yishuv of modernized people had not been imbued with the sense of mission and purpose to advance Hebrew culture, maybe the whole thing wouldn't have worked out. If it was just about tilling the soil and getting your hands dirty, maybe it would have failed.
Yeah, but he wasn't a big believer in Jewish self-governance.
Well, he doesn't address the matter because he doesn't think it's a realistic option anytime soon. And by the way, neither did your average political Zionist either. I mean, when we get to revisionism in the 1920s, that's when we first address the matter of those who want independence and want it now, even though the demographics don't allow for it. But your average mainstream political Zionist understands that you have to have a foreign overlord for a little while longer, because until there's at least enough Jews in the country to justify Jewish governance, you can't have Jewish governance. And if you don't have Jewish governance and you don't have a foreign overlord, what do you have? Arab governance and an Arab state. So it's way into the distant future, and Achad HaAm doesn't even want to know about it. So this is, we'll stop here for tonight. We're going to be off for about 5 weeks because there's Yontif, and then I go to Washington for a week. So we'll be back, I think, the first Tuesday in November. Nothing all of October. And we'll discuss at that time the beginnings of Herzlian Zionism. Okay.